Okay, it's wonderful to see everyone. I want to express my hakaras hatov to my parents who are sponsoring tonight's shiur in memory of my grandmother, Liba Bas Lipa. My grandma Lila was a very wonderful, incredible woman, even though I grew up far away from her in California. So we had California cousins and we had New York cousins. And my grandmother, who lived in Linden, New Jersey, used to make snowballs in the winter and freeze them. And then when all the California cousins would come in the summer, she would take them out of the freezer. And they're, of course, individually, each snowball was individually wrapped. And then there was a larger wrapping. And we would have this huge snowball fight on her lawn. And cars would drive down the road and they'd like stop and then like back up and try to understand what was going on here. Because it was July, it was 102, and a bunch of kids were outside throwing snowballs at each other. But that was my grandmother, and she was a very incredible woman. When I was at YU, I used to have the chance to spend Shabbos at her house, which were very special. And it was very special to watch my kids grow up with her. And it's hard to believe it's 12 years since she's gone. And even though I appreciate very much the influence that she's had on our lives, and very much still feel her presence, she would have been so proud of the shul, but we wouldn't have gotten anywhere because she would have just been telling all of you how great I am. pretty much you wouldn't have gotten out of shul. So I definitely learned to talk and talk and talk from her. I think we could say that's definitely her gene. So the sermon lengths are all also le'ilui nishmaso. So I think we can... okay. All right, so tonight's topic, we're all in the process of getting ready for Purim. This Shabbos, we're going to read Parsha Zachar. I'm always inspired by people's zeal for Shabbos Zachar. It's one of those mitzvos. I always feel like Shabbos Zachar kind of kicks off the more obsessive religious season. You know, the zecher, the hearing every word, you know, I always feel like sort of Pesach cleaning kind of begins with Shabbos Zachar. You know, that everything's got to be perfect, everything's got to be okay. I know there are shuls, they read it in multiple nuschos, multiple different things. And I always like to remind the people in our shul that there are many mitzvot we do that involve mitzvot d'oraisa of reading things, like Kriya Shema. And so we should try to, you know, summon that sense of commitment and fervor for all of these things. But for some reason, Parsha Zachar lives in the consciousness of the Jewish people with a little bit extra sense of passion, a little bit of extra sense of focus. And part of it has to do with its proximity to Purim, as we're about to read this story and experience this story of Klal Yisrael being threatened by its enemies and ultimately vanquishing Haman. And part of it just has to do with, I think, what really resonates for us in terms of our historical experience. The notion of not forgetting, the notion of memory is very central to the religious consciousness of the Jew. And the concept of we are always somewhat embattled with the forces of evil, with forces that are pushing against us, is something that certainly resonates with the Gullus Jew. There's no question. And I think, especially today, you know, we are struggling now with some resurgence of anti-Semitism, some of the anxiety about the things that are going on with the JCCs. I was just at a rabbinic conference in Florida. We had 60 rabbanim there, and I don't think this is as much of a problem in Passaic, New Jersey, but in communities outside New York, where the primary educational institutions are in these buildings, and the people who are sending their children are not as committed, many of them. So the anxiety of safety issues is actually causing a crisis of Jewish education. You know, many of the parents are pulling the kids out, not sending them because they're so afraid. So the concept of Zechiras Amalek, it's in our story, it's in our consciousness, it's in our world, and even though we're so lucky to live in a generation where we've witnessed certainly so many sparks of redemption with the state of Israel, obviously we're still locked fiercely in a battle with other forces in terms of what they bring to the challenge of contemporary Jewish life. So Zachor, Amalek, it's something that speaks to us. So what I want to talk about tonight is not the mitzvah of Zechiras Amalek. It's not the mitzvah of Parshas Zachor. I want to talk about the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek, the mitzvah to destroy Amalek, and raise some questions that I think we're sometimes afraid to ask, and explore some of the different approaches that I think will resonate with us and also bring up interesting issues. So let's begin. So source number one is Sefer Bereishis. Sefer Bereishis and Perek Lamed Vav. If you look at the Pasuk Aleph, the Eila told us Esav hu Edom. These psukim trace the genealogy of Esav. And in Pasuk Yud, the Torah tells us Eila Shemos b'nei Esav, Eliphaz ben Ada Eshes Esav, Reuel ben Basmas Eshes Esav, and then their children, Vitimna haya Pilegesh le Eliphaz ben Esav, Atelid le Eliphaz es Amalek, Eila b'nei Ada Eshes Esav. So Amalek is in the genealogical strand of Esav, and Amalek eventually, as many of these individuals that are part of the history of the world, Amalek eventually develops into a people, develops into a nation. And we're all basically familiar with the story in source number two, in Sefer Shemos, Perek Yud Zayin, where the Torah tells us that Klal Yisrael was in the process of their liberation from Mitzrayim, and as they experienced Kriyas Yamsuf, the Torah tells us in Pasuk Ches, Vayavo Amalek, Amalek comes, Vayilochem im Yisrael berefidim, and wages war with Klal Yisrael in Refidim. And Moshe Rabbeinu says to Yehoshua, this is one of the first times that we encounter Yehoshua, Bechar lanu anashim, etzei lochem ba'amalek, go out and wage war with Amalek. And Moshe Rabbeinu goes up on the mountain, and Yehoshua gathers the people, and we all know the famous miracle, V'hoya kasher yorim Moshe v'gavar Yisrael, v'kasher yaniach yado v'gavar Amalek, Pasuk Yud Aleph. When Moshe would raise his hands, Klal Yisrael would win. When he would rest his hands, Amalek would emerge more victorious, and this was the encounter with Amalek. And the Torah tells us in Pasuk Yudad, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Ksov zos zikaron ba'sefer. One of the few times in the Torah where Klal Yisrael is commanded to enshrine something in history. Write this down. Make sure that there's a record of what happened here. What happened here doesn't say that about Yetzias Mitzrayim. Doesn't say that about Kriyas Yamsu. Doesn't say that about any of the stories of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah. Now, this story of Amalek, Sov Zos Zikaron Basefer. Somehow, this experience, this confrontation with Amalek is going to be embedded in the memory of the Jewish people. It has to be concretized, it has to be formulated, and it has to be perpetuated. And the Torah tells us, when you get to the land that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is ultimately going to give you, Timcha es zecher Amalek mitachas hashamayim lo tishkach. Erase the any vestige of Amalek from the world, and I'm sorry, I skipped into the other source. I apologize. The Ksoz of Zikaron ba'secher ki macho emcha es zecher Amalek mitachas hashamayim. Then in the next psukim, in source number three, this is Parsha Zachar. Zachar es asher asa lecha Amalek, remember what they did to you, baderech betzeischa mimitzrayim. Asher karcha baderech, that they came upon you, vayizanei b'cho konech ashalim acharecha, and they attacked all of the weak ones that were in the back, bata ayei feyageya, you were tired, you were removed, v'lo yorei elokim, v'ayob aniach Hashem lokech lecha mikol aivecha misaviv. When you finally get to Eretz Yisrael, timcha es zecher Amalek, mitachas hashamayim lo tishkach, don't forget. So the Navi tells us in Sefer Shmuel that Shmuel, the Navi, comes to Shaul and he says to Shaul, "Vayomer Shmuel el Shaul, Osi shalach Hashem limashchacha lemelech alamo al Yisrael. Hashem sent me to anoint you to be the king over the Jewish people. V'ato shema. Now listen, lekol divrei Hashem." To the voice and the words of Hashem, Ko amar Hashem tzibakos, pakati es asher asa Amalek li Yisrael. I remember, I'm focused on what it is that Amalek did to the Jewish people. Asher samlo baderech ba'aloso mimitzrayim, that they encountered them on the road as they left Mitzrayim. V'ato lech v'ikisa es Amalek, You should go out now and you should destroy Amalek. Vecharamtem es kol asher lo v'lo tachmol olof. You should destroy everything associated with them. V'lo tachmol olof. And you should not have any compassion for them. You should not have any rachmonas. Veheimato me'ish adisha. And you need to execute from man, although, lest you think this is just a battle with soldiers, the mitzvah is you have to destroy men, women, me'olel v'aryonik, and even the children and the babies, mishor v'adseh, all of their animals, migomol v'adchamor, all of their animals, from their gamal, their camels, to their donkeys, everything's going to go. Pasukei. Vayavo shol al ir Amalek, vayarev, vanachal, vayomer shol alikeni. Look, okay, he encounters Amalek. And vayach says in Pasuk Zayin, vayach shol es Amalek, shol hits Amalek, mechavila boach ashur ashal pnei Mitzrayim, vayisposh es agag melech Amalek chai. And yet shol goes ahead and he leaves over the melech of Amalek, the king of Amalek, he allows him to live. The nation he completely destroys, but he allows Agag to live. So what happened? And also on some of the better property of Nichamti. So this is what Hashem says in Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph. Hashem says to Shmuel, Nichamti. Nichamti means I have remorse. I have regret. Nichamti. Ki himlachti es shol lemelech. That we made this guy the king. Ki shav me'acharai v'estivarai lo ikim. Vayichar lishmua vayizak al Hashem. And this goes on. So this is the story of Amalek. The story is they attacked the Jewish people. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, we have a commandment to destroy this nation. Shol is finally given, Klal Yisrael is finally given sovereignty over the land of Israel, over the Jewish people. There's a national government, there's a king, and the king is given the mandate to go ahead and destroy the nation of Amalek, and Shol accomplishes that mandate, but he leaves over one individual, he leaves over the king, he leaves over Agag. And we're going to return to that whole question. So the first thing we need to understand, before we get into all of the moral questions, is why do we have this obsession with destroying Amalek? What is it about Amalek that is so significantly horrific? What is it about Amalek that puts them in this category, that there's no capacity for any tolerance that we would have such a mandate to go ahead and literally destroy an entire nation? So there are a number of different answers to this question. First is the Ramban. The Ramban tells us in source number 5, look at the second line, two words before the end of the line. V'tam ha'onesh. What's the reason for this punishment? Shene'enash Amalek yoser mikol ha'amim. That Amalek is punished more than any other nation. Ba'avur, because ki kol ha'amim, all the other nations, shamu v'yirgozu. They heard of Yitzias Mitzrayim, they heard of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's power and his influence and his kingdom, and they had a sense of reverence. Upileshes Edom Umoav Yoshve Kinan Nimog Umipnei Pachad Hashem Umehadar Go'ono. V'Amalek Bo Mimerchak Kimisgaber Al Hashem. The Amalek, who wasn't even there. Amalek is not geographically where Yetzias Mitzrayim took place. Amalek traveled from far away to confront God. So what's wrong with Amalek? Amalek represents, and Amalek embodies, and Amalek actualized an absolute irreverent confrontation with God. The notion, not since the Dor HaFlaga, did we have a nation that was interested in taking on God. You take on the Jewish people, immediately following Yetzias Mitzrayim, you are taking on God Himself. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to the Jewish people, this is a nation that has to be destroyed. Okay? The Abarbanel has a little bit of a different interpretation. The Abarbanel says the following. What's the problem with Amalek? What's so terrible? What is it about them that needs to be destroyed? Because Amalek fought for no reason. In the study of the ethics of war, right? And there's been a tremendous amount that's been written on this. What, this is a conflict in our own country. What permits a nation to go to war? War is violent. Well, obviously, if you're attacked and you're allowed to defend yourself. But where do we find just wars? What comprises a just war? Can you go to war for territory? Can you go to war preemptively? Can you go to war? What permits a nation to go to war? What allows a nation, what is considered a just war? So there's been discussion about this already from the Middle Ages. What's considered a just war? Says the Abarbanel, Amalek was simply interested in conquest for conquest's sake. They had absolutely no mitigating reason whatsoever for this battle. Kihine halochim, and people who fight, mehem shiyasu milchom tom keneged oivim, so sometimes people fight for territory. So today, with the United Nations, and with, you know, today it's not considered so mikubal. If the United States decided, you know what, it'd be nice if California was a little longer, right? So we'll go chop some Mexico and, you know, move the wall a little bit, and we'll, you wouldn't really want to do that anyway. I've been to Tijuana, it's no San Diego, I'll tell you that. Right? But there's, you know, you want a little more territory. Texas, pull it down a little bit, right? So today that's not considered so mikubal. But you can see nations, they're trying to develop themselves. They're trying to deal with they want natural resources. You could understand why a nation would say to itself, we want territory and we're willing to fight for that territory. Or if another nation tries to conquer you and you want to push back, you want to fight back. What did they do? Amalek had none of these justifications for war. The Jewish people aren't passing through their land. It's not like Amalek was coming to where the Jewish people were standing in Rephidim and captured territory so they could have an Amaleki outpost, so they could, you know, set up a camp there, set up a colony there. Nothing. Amalek hears that there's this nation that is emancipated from Mitzrayim. They simply travel to confront Klal Yisrael for no other reason than they have within themselves a fundamental aggression and desire to just overtake and overpower others. Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we cannot tolerate such a nation in the landscape of the world. That is unacceptable and that could not exist. And that is part of the ethos of Amalek. It's not just their military strategy. It emanates from their value system and that permeates all levels of their society and they're in every aspect of that experience. Says Abarbanel, that's why we have to get rid of them. Says Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, similar to the Abarbanel, but a little bit of a different approach. In the second line, "Bekoach haShilton eskano chemda hayichidi legalusam kvodam shel bnei adam," that Amalek's vision was that power is the key to anything; that the ultimate determination of a nation's trajectory, in terms of what it's going to be in the larger world, in the mindset of Amalek, was entirely related to power. That Amalek was not interested in alliances. Amalek was not interested in values. Amalek was not interested in... Amalek was simply a power-hungry entity, simply fighting for fighting's sake. That's Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. Rav Kuttner provides a little bit more of an introspective approach. Rav Kuttner says the following, and this is in his first essay in the Pachad Yitzchak on Purim. Says Rav Kuttner, that we know that Rashi says in Parsha Zohar, where the Torah says, "Asher karcha baderech," So Rashi says, that's a funny word, asher karcha baderek. So Rashi interprets it, loshon kur, v'chom tzunech v'vrishuch merisisecha. Rashi says that, and then he goes on to basically say a parable, that when the Jewish people came out of Mitzrayim, it was a very public thing, the miraculous salvation of Am Yisrael. The notion that a nation's historical destiny was literally shaped by God himself, that the Makos and the freedom from Mitzrayim, all of this was miraculous. And Klal Yisrael was at such an elevated status, and through Klal Yisrael, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's reverence in the world was at such an elevated status. Like a bath that's very, very hot. But we know that if you have a bath that's very, very hot, as soon as somebody goes in, that cools it off for everybody else. So when Amalek attacks the Jewish people, that cools it off for everybody else. So here's how he interprets that. Look at the 1, 2, 3, 4, about 5 lines down. Kolomar ein sof inyano shel Amalek bazeh shebav v'nilchem b'Yisrael. It's not just that they fought the Jewish people, like all the other interpretations that we saw. Elish is sof inyano hu bazeh. Shemilchamto shel Amalek garma zilzul bechashivuso shel Yisrael. What Amalek's actions did was it undermined any sense of importance, of chashivus, of reverence, of appreciation for something important. That's the koach of Amalek, metaphorically, that is so incongruent with something positive in the world. Amalek is interested in nothing being treated as important. Amalek's midah is one of cynicism, is one of bittul, is one of nullification, of anything important. Alufei Edom Elei Moav, and he goes on to say, Aval Amalek ena yachol lispo chashivos. Amalek can't handle chashivos, important things. Mahuso shel Yisrael, he koach hachilul. Mahuso shel Amalek, he koach hachilul. Amalek is all about being mechalel things. It's that, you know, if you've ever worked in camp, you know, and it takes a very long time on Friday night to get the dining room in camp quiet, right? So you're up in the middle of the circle, and you're doing shtick, and you're telling songs, and you're telling jokes, and you're, you know, and you finally got the room where you want, and everybody's totally silent and focused, and they're there, and we're going to be able to sing, and we're going to be able to have different Torah, and everybody's there. And there's like one kid in the back that always goes like, you know, and that's it. The whole thing's over. Everybody, that's the Amaleki. That kid, Camp Morishat, that's the Amaleki, right? That's right. That, what is that? That is the perversion of an atmosphere, of an environment that's been lifted in sanctity. And that is what Amalek did in the larger landscape of the world. That nothing is reverent, nothing is important, nothing is chashuv. Everything can ultimately be assaulted in terms of its foundational worth and its value. Source number 9 comes from an essay written by Rav Amital. Rav Amital writes the following. This is just an excerpt. We see here that what characterizes Amalek throughout the generations is the concept of mikre. Right? It says that Amalek comes asher korcha baderech. Korcha maderech means, and they happened upon the Jewish people. Now that's a strange word to use, because this was a intentional, deliberate, strategic assault. Why are you describing it as asher korcha maderech? That sounds like they just happened to bump into Klal Yisrael and attack them. So he says, the korcha refers to the nature, the inner nature of Amalek themselves, attributing everything to randomness and coincidence. While Am Yisrael is permanently on the way, baderech, a concept denoting continuity. Amalek maintained an ideology of non-ideology. Everything is permissible. There is no journey, there is no direction, everything is coincidental, there's no absolute value that must be held dear. Am Yisrael, in contrast, is always on the way. They have a direction and an objective. They have clear values to which they cleave. And that's a very, very insightful point and makes the whole notion of Amalek incredibly relevant to our world today. Because in terms of moral values, this is our big challenge. It's not that we have a certain set of values and society has another set of values. That was the battle of the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. They had their values, we had our values. How do you live with our values in a society with their values? That's not the challenge today. The challenge today is much more infectious. Challenge today is there are no values, there are no boundaries, there are no rules and regulations. In the postmodern world, structures, categories, in all areas of life are completely breaking down. And that is the nature of society in so many different areas of what defines our society. And Klal Yisrael is trying to live a life that is baderech. It has a certain openness to it. It has a certain ability to confront the real world. But there's a direction. There's a mahalach. There's a derech. There's a way to go. There's what we do. There's what we don't do. And that is becoming increasingly combative with the surrounding culture. That's really what Rav Amital is talking about. That there's living life b'mikra. There's living life where there are no boundaries, where there are no rules, and there's living life baderech. There's living life on a derech. And that derech has a certain approach, has a certain mahalach, but that's the challenge of Amalek, and that's why it's so important to destroy that line of thinking. So what does this mean? So these are nice ideas, and certainly all of these reasons resonate with us as nice ideas, but I don't know that these ideas, as chashuv as they are, and as much as they resonate with us, I don't know that they would motivate us to go ahead and commit a monumental genocide against another nation. Right? It's hard to understand how that gives us the license or the mandate or the moral ability to go ahead and destroy a whole people. So that's really what I want to discuss a little bit tonight. That is, how do we struggle with that? How do we understand that? So let's look at it a little bit together. The first thing we have to understand is, what is the mitzvah of Mechiyas Amalek? So the Sefer Achinuch tells us in mitzvah Tov Resh Dalet, in source number 10, look at the second paragraph, Dinei HaMitzvah. These are the dinim and the mitzvah. V'zos min HaMitzvah samutolos al HaTzibur kulon. So first of all, this mitzvah is given on the entire community. Like Chazal tell us, Shlosha mitzvahs, this is from a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Shlosh mitzvahs nitztavu Yisrael b'shas knisasan la'aretz. There were three mitzvahs that were given to the Jewish people when they entered Eretz Yisrael. Number one, limnos lahem melech, to appoint a king. The limnos lahem beis ha-bechira, to build the beis ha-migdash. Ulahachriz zera Amalek, and to destroy Amalek. So from that line in the Sefer Achinuch, you would assume that this mitzvah of destroying Amalek is not a mitzvah for Yaakov Glasser. It's not a mitzvah for, I don't know that I could destroy anybody, but assuming I had the physical capacity to hurt someone and not get very hurt in the process, which itself actually is a discussion in Halacha, to what extent do I have to be misaking myself to destroy Amalek? Remember, going to war, put yourself in danger. Right? So normally we don't say that you have to do that. You don't have to put yourself in danger. You only have to sacrifice your life for three mitzvos, right? Kili Arayas, Shvichas Damim, and Avodah Zarah. Amalek is not on that list. So Mehechi Tasty, that I have to go to war and risk my life in order to kill an Amaleki. But it sounds in the Sefer Achinuch like, no, this is a national, this is when we have a land, and we have a king, and we have an army, and this is one of the missions. One of the missions is to protect the land of Israel. One of the missions may be some territorial expansion. One of the missions to the army is go destroy Amalek. But the second line in the Sefer Achinuch is a little bit different. The MS, he says, Ki gamal kol yochid mi Yisrael. There is a mitzvah on each individual of the Jewish people. Hazicharim, mutol hachiyuv lahargom la'abdom min ha'olam. On the males, to go ahead and destroy them from the world. Im yesh koach biyadam, if they can, b'chol makom, and this is Sefer Achinuch language, in every place, which means it's not just in Eretz Yisrael, u'v'chol zman, and in all eras of history, which would mean it would apply right now. Im ulay yimotze echad mikol zarom. If you could find one, right? You have to find an Amaleki, right? Not everybody that is walking around that you don't like is from Amalek. Not everybody that they say is from Amalek in the newspaper, in the, you know, in some of the language that's used, is automatically from Amalek. But if we were able to, let's say, discover an Amalek genetic marker, right? And we knew for sure, right, that this guy that's, you know, that's always giving us a hard time, this is an Amalek. So that's it. Hineni muchun mezuman l'kayim mitzvah saseh, you know, the mechias Amalek. And that's it. And you do what you have to do. I don't know exactly how you kill the person or what you do, but that's the din. That's the mitzvah. The Minchas Meir says, you see from here, there are two aspects to this mitzvah. There's the general tzibur mitzvah, and there's the individual mitzvah. So the Minchas Aron asks, you know, what exactly does that mean if really this is supposed to be done in the context of war? So he suggests at the second half of source number 12, that Vanira Mizeh, the Milchemes Amalek came in Shehichriz HaKadosh Baruch Hu Olav Milchama Midor Dor. So what's interesting is we're picking up all the language from Parsha Zohar, since it says you have to do this Midor Dor in every generation. Imkein Lo Paska Milchama La Olam. It's always Betoris Milchama. We're always at war with Amalek. Gam Kishein Atzibur Misaseif Lihilachim. Even if we're not gathered together as a nation to fight, v'lachein kol echad v'echad, every single individual, shabalu yado amaleki, that runs into an amaleki, hariu mishtatef b'milchama haklilios azu al yedei mechiyasa. So you have different visions for this mitzvah. Some say this mitzvah is really a mitzvah hatzibur. This is only, you know, when it could be done as a nation. Some say no, it's only when it could be done as an individual. And some say, you're right, it could be done as an individual, but the individual is part of the larger context of the nation. The Smag, which is quoted in a kuntres that I saw from Rav Shulman, so the Smag writes, in source 13, Kaman de mitzvahs kibush ha'aretz kodemes l'mitzvahs mechiyas amalek, since it says in that Gemara, that first we have to conquer the land and then destroy Amalek, it's only a mitzvah when we're in the status of being in the land of Israel as a redeemed people. So the Smag says, no more dinim of killing Amalek. Even if you knew for sure that someone was an Amaleki, there's no more killing Amalek until Mashiach comes. Because even if you want to say that what's happening now in the land of Israel has some sort of messianic initial connotations, there's nobody who believes we are living in a completely redeemed world. We are living in the Zman of Galus. All of the simanim that the Nevi'im give us and the Gemara gives us for what it means to be B'Yemosa Mashiach, we don't have Mashiach yet. So until then, this mitzvah doesn't apply. That's the opinion of this Smag. I happen to be reading a new biography that came out on Rav Gussman. Rav Gussman passed away not that long ago. Rav Gussman lived. Rav Gussman was a phenomenal personality. He was the youngest dayan to ever serve on the Vilna Beis Din. I think he was 19 years old when Rav Chaim Ozer had him sitting on the Vilna Beis Din, and just a phenomenal personality. Has many, many talmidim. So Rav Gussman had to flee in World War II, and he ended up in the forest as a partisan fighting against the Nazis. He had a very tragic life at this point in time. His child died in his arms. Very terrible, terrible story. And he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Netzach Yisrael in Israel. They just actually rebuilt that whole yeshiva. If you ever go to Yerushalayim on Ramban Street, you know, at the corner there, there's a nice big yeshiva. That's the yeshiva Netzach Yisrael. That's where he was the Rosh Yeshiva. He's Rosh Yeshiva in America for a long time. Also, Sfarim's Kuntres Shiurim, if you ever see on the Gemara's beautiful Sfarim. So when Rav Gussman reached the forest, his plan was to become a partisan to fight against the Nazis and defend himself and his family. However, to be accepted as a partisan, there was a single condition. One had to bring a weapon. So where's he going to get a weapon? So Rav Gussman's opportunity came when he saw a lone Nazi soldier passing through a quiet place in the forest. Rav Gussman jumped the soldier, threw his rifle as far away as he could, and killed the soldier with his bare hands. This is a Rosh Hashiva. In Yerushalayim, Rav Gussman will look down at his hands and say, I was mekayim the mitzvah of being Mocha Zecher Amalek with my bare hands. So I called a Talmud of Rav Gussman, who lives in our community, and I asked him about this story. Is this story true? And he told me, Rabbi Love told me, that he heard this from him directly. He heard him say this a few times, that there's a 100% true story. This is not a situation of self-defense. I mean, the whole World War II certainly can be argued as an experience of self-defense. But this, in an isolated circumstance, this was a, you know, this was, and this was his attitude, that I was mekayim the mitzvah of being Mocha Zecher Amalek. So we have to understand, Nazis Amalek, we'll get to that too. But you see this tension, you see this question, is this, does this mitzvah live today? Does this mitzvah apply to an individual? Is this only for Klal Yisrael? What is this about? So let's talk a minute about what makes us uncomfortable about the mitzvah. When I say uncomfortable, I don't chas v'shalom mean that we have any questions about its divinity and about its ultimate morality, but we are, the Torah commands us to be thinking people. The Torah tells us that one of the most central mitzvahs we have is Talmud Torah. The mitzvah of Talmud Torah is to use your mind, to use your thoughts, to use your convictions and your ideas. You're not supposed to just sit back and say, and I guess everything's right, and not think, and not ponder, and not consider, and not struggle. It's the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. That's what the Torah is. The Torah wants us to be thinking people. So we have to think, and we have to struggle, and we have to try to understand, what does this mean? That we have a mitzvah to wipe out a nation. What does that mean? So why does it sit with so much discomfort? Because we're not a violent people. The Meshech Chachma in Source 15 makes such a beautiful comment. The Meshech Chachma says, if you look at just that first paragraph, about seven lines down, Ki kol ha'amim b'disoseyen anim yusios yasu yom ha'nitzachon yom ha'peles oivim l'chug chag nitzachon lo kein b'Yisrael. He's talking about why there isn't a special chag for Kriyas Yamsuf. He says, there's no chag. Why isn't there a chag to celebrate the miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf? Without Kriyas Yamsuf, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere. Because at the end of the day, Kriyas Yamsuf was not just about the salvation of the Jewish people. It was about the salvation of the Jewish people through the destruction of our enemies. And Jews don't celebrate the destruction of their enemies. It's a necessary thing that must be done. It's not celebrated. It's not embraced. We don't want to internalize it. And he uses a number of different examples. He says, for example, Hanukkah. The real miracle of Hanukkah was the war, was the fact that they won the war. Okay, a candle lasted for 8 days. It's a beautiful thing. It's a nice story. But at the end of the day, the military victory was the big victory. Yet the Chag is built around the Nes of the Shemen. Why? Because we don't glorify military victories. Purim, which we're going to celebrate, the day of Purim is not the day that they vanquished their enemies. It's the day Asher Nochu Bo HaYehudim. It's the day after. It's the day after they did so. And you see this, you know, coming up in various ways. I share with you an example only because it's so emotionally gripping. I don't share this with you as a proposed interpretation of Tanakh. I share it with you more because of who it's coming from, not the parshanut. But just keep in mind, this is from a book called Sages and Dreamers, which is a book by Elie Wiesel about Tanakh and various personalities in the Talmud. And he says he has a whole chapter on Esther. And at the very, very end, I caught this paragraph that just blew my mind. He says at the end, in conclusion, one question. Actually, one of my kids asked me this question yesterday. If indeed there was a miracle willed by God, if the whole point of the Megillah is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there for the Jewish people, why doesn't his name figure in the tale? Why doesn't God's name appear in Megillas Esther? So we know the Maimar Chazal, we know all the different answers. It's a Nes Nistar, you have to find Hashem in the Megillah. The HaMelech is Hashem in the Megillah. This is Elie Wiesel's question. That he chose to hide his face before and during the catastrophe is conceivable, and is reconciled with the traditional explanation of Hester Panim, or the divine eclipse. But why did he keep his name from the book after the event? Good kasha, right? I understand why the name of Hashem doesn't appear all throughout the story. It's a Nes Nistar. It's a hidden miracle. You got to find the God in Esther. You could read it as just a political drama. could read it as just a really, really good story. But if you look hard, you'll see God at all the pressure points of the story. But once the story is over, and it's just, you know, the after story, when you're sitting there, not this year, because we're not going to be fasting, and you're sitting there, and already by that point, you know, there aren't as many Hamans to boo, and you're already thinking, is it going to be a quiche? Is it going to be, what's it going to be over there? You know, you're already holding by the, you know, the end, and already it's starting to, you know, why can't there God's name show up? It has to be, the whole book doesn't have one name. It doesn't make sense. The book of Tanakh doesn't have the name of God at all. I think I mentioned this when we were creating a poster for something at YU, and we wanted to put a picture of a Torah or a scroll in the background. So every time we did it, we had to start again because we didn't want to make every poster have Shem Hashem. So someone said, let's just use Esther, right? Because we know that we can just take a clip and it won't be a problem. I believe that it is related to the end rather than the beginning of the story. What is the end, says Elie Wiesel? The Jews are saved, Haman is humiliated and finally hanged, and so are his 10 sons. And if that is not enough, the Jews obtain the king's permission, drafted by Mordechai, to take revenge and kill their enemies. I confess that I never did understand this part of the book or Esther. After all, a book of Esther. After all, the catastrophe was averted. The massacre did not take place. Why then this call for bloodshed? 500 men were slain in Shushan in one day, and 300 the next. 75,000 persons lost their lives elsewhere. Fact or fiction, the question remains, how could our ancestors celebrate Purim in the midst of such killing? Is this why we are told to get drunk and forget? To erase the boundaries between reality and fantasy? And think that it all happened only in a dream? Or is it a way of coping with the hidden frustrations? One day a year to imagine acts of violence during Purim when it is but a game, a play, so as to impress upon ourselves the lesson that they are prohibited on all other days. This must explain why God chose not to give his name to the book of Esther. He refused to be associated with the denouncement with the bloodshed. It was his way of saying, don't ascribe this to me. I had nothing to do with it. You wanted revenge, all right, but don't make me responsible for it. For to be Jewish means to have earned the right to punish our enemies, who inevitably turned out to be the enemies of mankind, and to choose not to. And that's from a survivor of the Shoah who lost his whole family in the Shoah. This is part of our legacy also, that we are not interested in hurting people. We're not interested in taking revenge on people. We're not interested in... So how do we deal with this mitzvah? How do we deal with this commandment? And how do we get so excited about Parsha Zohar when the implications of it for our own morality seem so challenging? So in source number 17, you could see there was an interesting article by Rabbi Lam. He also formulates the question and crystallizes the question, but he also makes a qualifying point that I think is important to understand. So some people take the approach that our whole assumption is erroneous, that whatever halacha, whatever Ratzon Hashem says to do, that's what's good, that's what's excellent, that's what's wonderful. And our categories are the ones that are skewed. So even though there's a piece of us that when we're told there's a commandment to wipe out a nation, men, women, and children, even though there's a piece of us that's saying to ourselves, I don't know, like that, I don't know if I could do that. Could you really do that? I'd rather find a nicer esrog. You know what I mean? Like I'll buy a nicer, you know, I'll obsess over that one. I'll leave this one to, you know, I mean, can we really do that? Can we really? So one approach is to say, no, that there's something wrong with us. That our morality has to be shaped by Ratzon Hashem. Ratzon Hashem is to destroy Amalek. And therefore, this is our problem. That really, this is good. This is right. This is the will of Hashem. And there's nothing else to talk about. And there's definitely truth to that. But the question is, if that's enough, if that's something that we can live with. So I want to share with you a very interesting excerpt from a long article. We're not going to read the whole thing, but I gave it to you so you could explore it on your own. From a Liechtenstein. In 1982, when Israel was heavily entrenched in the war in Lebanon, so there was a massacre that took place at Sabra and Shatila, which were refugee camps. And basically there were warring armies, and the IDF, while they certainly did not take part in any of these massacres, they were called to task for allegedly allowing them to happen, or not intervening. At the time, the minister who was responsible for this area of the government, I remember if he was Minister of Defense at the time, was Ariel Sharon, and this law, and since he, as it was back then, was more of a hawk and on the right, so this created a tremendous controversy around him, and this had a lot of implications in a lot of different directions. One of the things that happened when this occurred is Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital spoke out against the government. They spoke out against the army. You have to understand, they were Rosh Yeshiva of a Hezder Yeshiva. All of their guys were in the army. They themselves were involved in the army. They represented the moral voice of the Hezder movement, of the religious Zionist ideology. But they felt so strongly that this was such a massive Chil Hashem on such monumental, epic proportions that they felt the need to speak out. And this caused a tremendous, this wasn't the last time that he did this, this caused a tremendous controversy, and there were letters from other Rosh Yeshiva against them. The next time this happened was also after the Baruch Goldstein situation that occurred in Maris HaMachpelah. Rav Lichtenstein also was very, very upset that they were maspid him in Kiryat Arba, and he wrote a letter. And in tradition, there are a collection of letters back and forth between the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshivos in Kiryat Arba and Rav Lichtenstein debating back and forth, Rav Lichtenstein feeling that this is a tremendous Chilul Hashem. In the context so he writes the following. I published an open letter to the Prime Minister. Among other things, this letter dealt with the issue of force and the motivation behind it. I asked, why is it, and then he gives a pshat in the story of Shaul and Agag that is so brilliant and so nuanced, and really, I think, takes this whole conversation to a very different place. He says the following, why is it that Shaul was punished for not killing Agag, the king of Amalek? Was it simply for not having killed the last remaining Amalekite? I suggested, right, is that really all it was? That, like, Mamish, give the guy some credit. This wasn't an easy thing to do. He's a good person. He went against his nature. He killed all these people, just like God said to him. He had Rachmanis on one guy. So you're going to take him to task? And he, Mamish, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah mechias. Mamish, like, mahadrin min a mahadrin on everybody else. What it must have taken to do that. And yet, he missed one guy. So says Rav Lichtenstein, I suggested that he was punished not just for sparing Agag, but because the fact that he refused to kill Agag placed in a totally different light is killing of all the other Amalekim beforehand. What does that mean? So he explains. Shaul had been commanded to take a whole people and kill them. And this is, morally, a frightful thing. The only justification lies in it being a response to an unequivocal divine command. In other words, this is something that we're supposed to find morally repulsive. We who have absorbed the mitzvot HaTorah, the fact that we're not allowed to kill, we're not allowed to harm people, we have to live lives of virtue and chesed and rachamim, and we're supposed to find this mitzvah hard. We're supposed to find this mitzvah difficult. This is not one of the ones we do, Ivduas Hashem B'Simcha. Therefore, if Shaul had been motivated in his actions purely by fear of God, by obedience to the Tzav, then he should have followed the command to the letter. In other words, if Shaul was doing what he was supposed to be doing, which is finding this to be personally repulsive, but you have no choice, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to do this, you're going to do it, then you follow the command all the way through, and you kill all of them. Once you have Rachmanis on one, what does that show? What does that show? That shows that this isn't about following the command of God. If this was about following the command of God, then you would have gotten everybody. What is this about? This is about some baser impulse, some instinctive violence. And the proof is that he killed everyone, but spared his peer, his royal comrade. If that is the case, then Shaul was not punished for sparing Agag. Rather, he had to be punished because of the Amalekim that he did kill. And that's the Chiddush of Rav Aaron. This is not just a Maisa HaMitzvah. This is not just, you know, how many Amalekim can you kill? This is a mindset. This is a surrender to Ratzon Hashem in an inexplicable way. In a way that it just does not make... Just like when Avram Avinu walks to the Akedah, and the Medrash tells us that the conversation that he has with Yitzhak, this is hard, this is difficult, this is not evil, we're going to do this. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to Shaul and says, you have to wipe out this nation. So if Shaul is doing what's proper, he closes his eyes and he says, all right, I'm an Eved Hashem, and I'm going to do what you said. But once he doesn't do what he said, not only is he held responsible for not killing Agag, but he's held responsible for all of the Amalekim that he did kill. Because it shows where that came from. It shows that that came from an inner sense of violence. That came from an inner place of immorality. And he goes on to obviously apply this for the situation that he's in. And you're welcome to read the more of it. So this is the mahalik of Rav Aaron. That it's something that we have to find morally troubling, that's okay, that we live in a generation where we find this difficult, and lav dafka that anybody ever didn't find this difficult. We find this difficult. We don't understand it. But at the end of the day, this is Ratzon Hashem. Ratzon Hashem does not mean that we have to be comfortable with everything that we are dealing with. But is this, what's fascinating is this really, in fact, shaykh in our day and age? So just to take you quickly, the Mishnah Yadayim tells us that Sancherev, Melech Ashur, mixed up all the nations. So the Rambam tells us in Mishnah Torah, in source number 20, the Rambam says the following, Mitzvah Asei Lahachrim Shivas Amimim, Shenemar Hachrim Tachrimim. There's a mitzvah to wipe out the seven nations. Now look, this is very important, the language. V'kol sheba liyado echad mehen. And if you meet one of these people, a Yavusi, v'lo hargo, and you don't kill the Yavusi, over below sase, you violate a lo sase in the Torah. Shedemar, as it says, lo sechaya kol neshama, don't leave any of them over, and then the Rambam says, ukvar ovad zichram, and they're gone. Those people are gone. The seven nations, they're gone, we don't know where they are. The Ridbaz says, sarcherev is mevalbel the world, we don't know where they are. The Rambam says, V'chein, in Halacha Hey, mitzvah sasei, la'abed zecher amalek, to destroy amalek. Shenemar timcha zecher amalek, u'mitzvah sasei lizkor t'amin ma'isa haroim. V'ari baso, k'dei la'orere baso. Should always remember amalek, what they did, and their hatred for how they behaved. Shenemar zachar sh'asa l'cha amalek, mi'pi ha'shmu alamdu, zachar b'peh, lo tishkach b'leiv, sh'asar lishkoach e'baso v'sonoso. You can't forget what they did. And then the Rambam goes on to talk about other things. Rav Soloveitchik, in his famous essay, his famous speech that was then written down, called Odido Fake, in source 22, talks about divine providence is testing us once again. The crisis is overtaking the land of Israel. The matter not just affects the political future. The designs of the Arabs are directed not just against the political sovereignty of the state of Israel, against the very existence of the Yeshuv, and he basically writes, they wish to destroy, heaven forbid, the entire community, men, women, infants, suckling, ox and sheep, quoting from the Psukim in Shmuel. At a Mizrahi convention, I cited the view expressed by my father and master of Moshe Soloveitchik, that the proclamation that the Lord will have the war with Amalek from generation to generation does not only translate into the communal exercise of waging obligatory war against a specific race, but includes as well the obligation to rise up as a community against any people or group that filled with maniacal hatred directs its enmity against Knesset Yisrael. When a people emblazons on its banner, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may no more be in remembrance. They become Amalek. In the 30s and 40s, the Nazis with Hitler at their head filled this role. They were the Amalekim, the standard bearers of insane hatred and enmity during the era just past. Today, their place has been taken over by the mobs of Nasser and the Mufti. And if we are silent now as well, I know not the verdict will be issued against us by the God of justice. So Rabbi Soloveitchik, quoting his father, says that Amalek, and this is a tremendous chiddush, Amalek's not a genealogical group. Amalek's not a nation, it's not a race. Amalek is a certain set of behaviors, a certain set of attitudes, a certain outlook on the world. Amalek represents whomever in a particular generation, midor dor, is rising up against the Jewish people in a maniacal way. Not people who are making life a little difficult for us. That we have, Baruch Hashem, plenty of, right? Doesn't make you an Amaleki. Makes you not like the DMV. That's not an Amaleki, right? Even though you feel like it would be a mitzvah to mamish, you know, right? What makes somebody an Amaleki? The mamish, there's a plan to throw the Jewish people into the sea. It's part of the charter of Hamas. That's Amalek. So in the footnote 25, which I invite you to read on your own, he's medayik this from the Rambam. He says that when the Rambam said that there is no, when the Rambam said that there's a mitzvah to destroy the seven nations, he says v'kvar ovad zichrom, and they're not around anymore. But when he said there's a mitzvah to destroy Amalek, he does not repeat that phrase. Why doesn't he repeat that phrase? Because the Rambam knew where the Amalekites lived? No. The Rambam didn't know where the Amalekites were. He didn't repeat that phrase. It must be that Amalek's not a nation like those nations. That Amalek's a concept. Amalek's an entity. Amalek's an attitude. Amalek's an anti-Semitic, maniacal drive against the existence of the Jewish people for no reason. That's Amalek. In every generation, that's Amalek. And this Rav Soloveitchik is quoted everywhere. Usually not in his name, but it's quoted everywhere. It's from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and it's a very important concept. In Rabbi Lam's article, he actually takes issue with the Rav's idea. Takes issue, believe it or not, with the Rav's interpretation of the Rambam. We'll leave that on its own. But he says this creates other moral problems. Because what exactly are you saying? Are you saying that the Nazis are Amalek? So what about the next generation? Their children. Amalek is supposed to destroy the children. So are their children Amalek? The Germans that are there now Amalek? Are they always Amalek? You know, what's the story? And that issue actually comes out in Halacha. We only have a couple more minutes. But that issue actually emerges in Halacha because there's a whole discussion that when Klal Yisrael goes to war, we're first supposed to offer ourselves b'shalom. If the nation accepts us, then we don't go to war. But if they don't, then there's a war. The Rambam, against the Pshat and the Psukim, and against the Rishonim before him, the Rambam says this applies to Amalek also. That you didn't have to go out and track down every Amalekite and kill them. There was no such mitzvah. The mitzvah was to confront the nation, to say, are you ready to change? You ready to make peace? You ready to... If they said yes, you're done. And if they didn't, then you had a mitzvah to destroy all of them. So that already tempers this tremendously, right? That it's not a proactive mitzvah in that way. Now, Avnei Nezer works this through. Why it is that the Shivas Amim are not like that, but Amalek is, because the Shivas Amim are nations that are living in that area, in that culture, living a life of decadence, whereas Amalek is just being held accountable for the sins of their parents. And the Gemara says, if you repeat the sins of previous generations, you're responsible, and you're responsible for what they did. If you don't repeat the sins of previous generations, then you're not responsible for what they did. there's a contradiction between the Mechilta and the Gemara. The Mechilta says that we're not allowed to accept Gerim from Amalek. The Gemara says, that's in source number 28. The Gemara says in source 29 in Gittin, that the descendants of Haman are learning Torah where? In Bnei Brak, right? Yushalayim, no. Right? Shalayim, that's a pashut yeshiva. That's a shtickle, you know. They're holding. They're mamish. They're in Bnei Brak. Doesn't get better than that, right? So, what does that mean? The descendants of Haman are in Bnei Brak. So, there's a whole discussion whether or not we're allowed to accept a gerus from someone that is part of Amalek. And that's a discussion. The Gilyan Ashas has an opinion. Maybe it only goes through the mother, it only goes through the father, and if they had a different mother, then it would be mutter. Emek Bracha discusses it. And the last source I just wanted to share with you is the Chukas Ager, where the Shaila actually came up, where someone who was a Nazi in World War II and committed atrocities and did tshuva, right? Whatever. They realized what they did was terrible, what they did was horrible, they had remorse, they wanted to do tshuva, and they wanted to convert. And they came to the Beis Din and they said, will you convert us? So the response of the Beis Din was basically, this is repulsive, this is disgusting. Like, how could we call this person who participated in such a horrific experience. How can we even call them, you know, a brother? How can we even, you know? But he writes at the end, and then he says that in the end, I can't give you a halakhic reason why it would be forbidden. I can't tell you halakhically why it would be forbidden. So that's itself an interesting discussion. I want to just conclude with one insight from Rav Kook. Rav Kook writes, we know we have a mitzvah of mechias amalek, to wipe out amalek, to erase amalek. So Rav Kook says, you know, in the laws of Shabbos, there's a prohibition of erasing. You're not allowed to erase on Shabbos. But if you just erase something, that's mutter. Okay? It's not mutter, but it's not a terrible thing. The only time, because it's destructive, the things that are prohibited on Shabbos are things that are constructive. If you erase something, if you're mochek al menas lichtov, if you erase something in order to write, that's awesome. That's mamish, that's violating Shabbos. So Rav Kook says the following, it's so beautiful. Says, if your attitude towards mechias amalek is you just want to destroy, you just want to erase, you just want to wipe out, that's not constructive. If your attitude is a mochek al menas lichtov, you're erasing for the purpose of writing something new. You're eradicating this evil because you are trying to create and fill that void with a sense of positivity and a sense of, then you're really involved in the mitzvah of mechias amalek. So our goal is not to just boo Haman. And our goal is not to just stand there with reverence at Parsha Zohar and tell ourselves how terrible Amalek is. Our goal is to expel evil from the world. And it's difficult for us to understand because the Torah sanctions violence in order to eradicate evil. That's not something that we're used to. We don't, but that's the values of the Torah. It's not something that we can do today. It's not practical. But we have to recognize that in our value system, life is not of eternal value. Life of virtue is of eternal value. But life in and of itself is not an absolute categorical value. If that life is completely immersed in evil, that's something that we want to erase. It's something that we want to get rid of. I don't know that I could do it. I don't know that you could do it. But in the Torah system of morality, that is a reality. But it doesn't license us to take a disposition of violence and antagonism. What it does is it helps us understand that our goal is to make the world better, is to improve the world. We're not just trying to destroy something, we're not just trying to rip something down. We're trying to build something up. We're trying to create. And this is what we have to daven for. That Kadosh Baruch Hu should give us the wisdom and should give the world the wisdom to be able to recognize that there are moral absolutes and there are things in the world that are right and there are things in the world that are wrong. And that part of Purim is recognizing those lines and recognizing that there is an obligation and there is a mandate to live a life and to celebrate the values that are good and that move society forward and to eradicate the values that are evil and pull society back. And that's our responsibility as human beings, to be able to move the world forward and to expel that evil wherever we find it. A wonderful and Freilich and Purim.